House Committee on Revenue for February 24th, 2015 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2097. Chris?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2097 is a litmus test to see how badly you really want to deal with personal income tax issues. It deals with some clarifications from a piece of the grand bargain from fall of 2013. Just for background information, part of that bargain was a preferential tax rate system for pass-through income, as long as it was non-passive income. And this is income from S corporations and partnerships and certain LLCs that get taxed through the personal income tax system. And after the grand bargain in the fall of 2013, in the December revenue forecast, the OSCPA group came forward and provided a bunch of what they considered clarifying issues. And in the 2014 session, there was one such bill, Senate Bill 1534, I believe, that addressed a number of those technical issues. And this bill continues that process. And I'll be using the term technical corrections, although the understanding of some of these are still evolving. But the four issues that are included in the bill, the first one is a clarification that the income subject to those rates must be from Oregon sources. And I'm trying to pull up the bill so I can reference the line number here. And that's on page 1, line 10. It just clarifies that it's from Oregon sources. And this is a piece that had some controversy in 2014, so it wasn't included there. It was included here again. And the notion here is to try and get at the issue of that the preferential rate would be applicable only to businesses in Oregon, with the intent of the policy being a tax cut for qualifying businesses, that presumably they would take that tax savings and reinvest it in the business. And there were certain issues or potential technicalities where, for example, you had a business in Portland and they had some customers in, some of their customers were in Washington. And one of the concerns about Oregon sources is that in that case, would they have to separate their income from their Washington customers and from their Oregon customers? The intent behind the language is that they're an Oregon business, so it would apply to all of their income. There is some concern about whether or not this language actually does that. To flip that example, you have a business, somebody living in Portland, and their business is in Washington, then presumably they would not be eligible for the tax cut because the business is outside of Washington. So that's the concept behind the from Oregon sources, although it is not free from controversy. The next two pieces, continuing down onto page 2, there is some bold language in lines 16 and 17, but I'll get to that. That's part of the language in lines 27 through 33. So paragraphs 7 and 8 get at this notion of grouping. There are some special circumstances within the tax code. And the idea here is to simply align the Oregon treatment with the federal treatment, just to make the tax filing process streamlined a bit. Under paragraph 7, I think the taking a little bit of some liberties here, but trying to get at as simple an explanation as possible, you can have a business that from an economic perspective is one economic entity, but for other reasons they have structured that business to be two or three businesses for a variety of other reasons. And the example that I've used in talking with people and on the Senate side, because Senate Bill 59 is the same, or largely the same policies or technical changes, is that I'm a widget manufacturer, and so that's what I do. I produce all of them, but I've structured myself to have three businesses. One is the manufacturing entity, one would be the marketing arm, and then I'd have another entity that owns the building where I operate. And so And I've done that for a variety of other reasons, but all of the income due to the rental property would be passive income. It's rental income, so it would be passive. But Section 469 of the IRC would allow me to treat all of those three legal businesses, legally separate businesses, as one business, because they are from an economic perspective. And right now, under the way the Department of Revenue, and I think Department of Revenue is still going through the process of interpreting the language, so I don't know that anything's definite yet. So for them, I don't want to speak for them. But if this change weren't in place, then the business would have to, they would be treated as one entity for federal purposes, and then to take advantage of the special provisions in Oregon, they would have to separate out that passive income because that's not eligible. But paragraph 7 would just keep all of that lumped together, so all of it would be painted the same color, so to speak. So that's the streamlining aspect. Although in recent days we've gotten some concerns about that language and whether or not that would open up a lot of passive income to be painted as non-passive income. And we're working through that right now. Paragraph 8A is another kind of lumping factor where you can have businesses that are considered qualified joint ventures. And these are businesses where the only members are the husband and wife. So we're talking about joint returns. We're talking about a husband and wife, and they're running a business. And for all intents and purposes, they look like a partnership, but they have chosen to be considered a qualified joint venture. Basically, they don't want to be treated as a partnership. And as a result, under current law, if they make this choice, they would just file two separate Schedule Cs. And since they would file Schedule Cs, they would not be eligible for the preferential tax rates, which was part of the policy decision from the grand bargain. This particular provision simply codifies how DOR will implement it. They've talked about this one, and under their interpretation of current law, is this is how they would implement it. These people have chosen to file Schedule C under the federal law, so they would continue to file Schedule C. So in that respect, there's no change, but it does help in many cases to codify how DOR is going to implement the language anyway. And as far as I'm aware at this point, that piece doesn't have any controversy. So, and then the last piece in here is Section 1231 gain. And this is a gain from the sale of business assets or involuntary conversion. So it's a kind of capital gain, so a kind of passive income that would not be subject, that would not be eligible for the lower tax rate. So presumably that is in keeping, by including this, it's clarifying and in keeping with the intent of the policies within the grand bargain. And then the last thing I would mention in Section 2 is the applicability date, and it has January 1, 2016. And if the committee chooses to move forward with any of these clarifications, I would suggest moving that to January 1, 2015, just simply because the policy is taking effect now, so there's no reason to have one set of rules for 2015 and then we'll change them in 2016. Yep. So, and as I mentioned in passing, this is largely equivalent to Senate Bill 59, although Senate Bill 59 as introduced did not have the language regarding from Oregon sources or the Section 1231 piece. Okay. Although the from Oregon sources is in an amendment under consideration in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee.
So they're considering the equivalent bill now.
If we include that amendment, then the only difference is the Section 1231 gain.
Okay.
Right. But the larger intent behind this is a clarification of the policies within the grand bargain related to the pass-through entity. I think everyone is aware, the grand bargain had a number of significant tax policies in it. Both this bill and Senate Bill 59 just deal with the pass-through income tax rates. But as the discussion about Senate Bill 59 has moved forward, some issues have been raised regarding a couple of these things that I'm still referring to as technical provisions, although I am reaching out to CPAs and folks to get more detail to figure out if that's an accurate characterization.
What they think, right?
Yes.
Okay. Questions for Chris or Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chris, I'm going to skip over Oregon sources and just go to the language found in 27 to 30
on page 2.
There's been a suggestion that a somewhat similar situation would allow a taxpayer to select among groups, but this is the opposite of that. That where a taxpayer has two or three different businesses all related, they would be treated as an economic unit.
Correct. So from an economic perspective, it looks like one business, but for various reasons, not all of which, or many of which I suppose I could articulate, there are legal entities, and so they get separated. And part of the motivation behind that is this passive income and non-passive income, and there are a variety of reasons why they may be structured differently. So the idea here is however it's treated at the federal level continues to be treated here. So that's the taxpayer-friendly characterization.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So my question really is, if the taxpayer was trying to choose among those separate businesses all owned by, let's say, the same group, does the bill prohibit that from happening? This isn't quite the right language here. This is somewhat different. But if you had five or six different businesses all owned by the same person, can you select among them, having your losses in one and your gains in another, under the current law?
I'm not sure if I follow the question. The perspective there is kind of a bottom line treatment. For however many businesses somebody owns, then they could have non-passive income from one business and passive income from another business. And what gets grouped together from a taxpayer perspective would be all of their non-passive income.
You're asking a slightly different question,
yes,
aren't you?
Yes,
yeah.
I am. Yeah.
Yeah.
I probably should send you the hypothetical. That would be the fastest way to get it absolutely right, so I will do that, because it's not quite what this issue is. It's different than this issue.
Okay.
Let me go to another one, if I may.
Yeah, please. Well, before we go on, let me just say I would like to have an explanation of Section 469, maybe not today, but how it, I mean, what that means in terms of this election to group-related business entities, and when one might elect and one might not elect, and what that means in terms of the effect on Oregon's tax revenue as it relates to this subsection 7. That would be my add to the question you've already gotten from Representative Vance. Representative, you have different topics.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dropping down to line 34, there's been a suggestion that timber sales from small timber landowners should be in some fashion deemed qualified for the treatment under this bill by virtue of the activity that type of business requires, thus making it not passive income, but instead otherwise. That issue also, I think I'm going to present to you in the form of a hypothetical, which I'll send to you, and we can discuss it later. But I think it does come up here.
Is 1231 related to timber, or can it be?
It can be, I think.
It can be.
It's not categorically a timber thing.
Okay.
It's the sale of business assets.
Yeah, for those of us who aren't tax experts, I think understanding what these particular Internal Revenue Code provisions actually do would be useful. And Representative Vince, that was the question you were asking the other day on this bill, wasn't it? I'm sorry, the one on sub 7, on line 27.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Did you have others?
I do have one other.
Yeah.
Sure, thank you. I want to go back to line 10 from Oregon sources. What is our plan? Is our plan to wait for the Senate, or is our plan to proceed with our own discussion of this particular issue?
I think I'd like to consult with Senator Hass to see. There's no point in duplicating the work. On the other hand, at some point, we're going to have to understand the concepts,
right,
whether they're in this bill or in Senate Bill 59.
Anyway, Mr. Church, I was just remembering that debate, and I can go back and, believe it or not, find my notes from it and come back in here and work our way through it again, which I'm happy to do, but I don't want to if it's the same thing that's happening in the Senate. Or at least I want to do it the most effective way possible.
Okay. Well, I think perhaps that's a question I ought to ask Senator Hass when I meet with him about what his intentions are for this bill. A lot of this stuff appears to me to be a clarification, technical, but some of it may not be. And I think you've raised some of the questions that suggest it might not be.
Yeah. I would agree. I would suggest there's quite a bit of consequence to this bill.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I note that we had a bill on the that, generally speaking, has the same topic that would make major changes in the system. But I don't think included any of these changes, did it?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. They've been kept separate.
So in that sense, these are parallel conversations that, if whatever we end up doing, will end up having to be in one bill, probably. Yes,
makes sense.
Other questions for Chris? Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
So are there any other businesses that are considered joint ventures in this state that are not a husband and wife? Is there any other classification?
Great
or
question.
Are you changing this only to a husband and wife as a joint venture?
Representative Whitsitt, to my understanding, and I'm still learning more, the qualified joint venture in this language refers only to a husband and wife situation. In other words, it has to be a husband and wife to be considered a qualified joint venture.
Okay.
Two brothers or two unrelated people can't be a qualified joint venture in this sense.
Do we know why this is limited to a husband and wife? Is it only because of the connection to how it's treated on the federal forms, the C?
It is because of federal law, but I'll need to do some more digging to find out the special circumstances driving it.
Great. Does the department want to be heard on this bill? No? Do we have any witnesses? That suggests those who are interested have dependent upon Chris to give an adequate explanation of what this is about. And I don't see anybody rushing up. Is there anyone who would like to be heard on this bill today? Obviously, we're not done with the concept, with the concept area. Whether this bill would be back or not, I do not know. I don't see anyone. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2097. Do I have everybody here? No, not quite. Okay. I was going to go to work session for committee bills, but let's not until we get our other members back. So are you on any of the other bills today?
No,
you're not. Okay, great. So let's go to our public hearing on House Bill 2169. Open that public hearing. And Christine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2169 would require any state agency that issues grants to other individuals or corporations to require the applicant demonstrate a compliance with personal income tax laws, corporate income or excise tax laws, and cigarette and tobacco taxes in order to receive the grant. And also this one, and it's different from the measure yesterday on compliance, because it also requires compliance with the withholding requirements, while the other one did not affect this. This would also make an exception for recipients of grants less than $25,000 in a year, recipients of temporary assistance for needy families, child welfare services under ORS 418005, services to the elderly, or persons with disabilities under ORS 410070, and 412014, nutritional assistance, vocational rehabilitation services are all exemptions from this requirement. It would define factors that the agency, board, commission, or Department of Revenue may consider when making determination whether the individual or corporation is in compliance. Requires the department to enter into an agreement with an agency, board, or commission to assist in the administration of the tax compliance requirement. And the measure does not have a specific date in which it takes effect, but it says that it takes effect when the director of the Department of Revenue formally notifies the Legislative Council, stating that the department has established an electronic system for the state agency, board, or commission to determine whether an individual is in tax compliance.
Okay. Questions for Christine? Let me note that I had a visit. Do we have witnesses signed up for this bill?
No.
You don't. Let me note that this morning I had a visit from Department of Human Services that has some additional suggestions for amendment of the bill. I don't recall all of the specifics, but they had to do with additional exceptions for people in crisis and other low-income support. I've put in a amendment draft request to allow that, because the object of this bill is, I think, is not to go after people who are in distress, but rather to deal with business entities that that want support from the state for a variety of things, but haven't paid their taxes. Questions, comments? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any idea how many corporations, organizations, applicants are going to be affected by this?
You know, at this time, I don't know. I could compile a list. It would probably take some different information from various agencies that would issue these types of grants, but I could learn more about it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious what state agencies, boards, commissions that are issuing the grants think this will impose upon state agencies, boards, or commissions when it comes to determining compliance. So what I'm really asking is, how much work are we imposing upon those groups, and who's going to do it, mm-hmm. and the cost thereof?
Okay, good question. My response to that kind of question is, they're not here, and one assumes that they don't have a problem with the bill if they're not here. That's always been my assumption, because if we had made any other assumption, we wouldn't be able to do any work, probably.
Chair Barnes?
Yes. Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you. Well, I think this is really interesting. You know, I know when I was with Clackamas County and in other jobs that I've had, I've become aware of some business incentives that the state government provides, and I certainly think it's an interesting idea that as a condition of receiving grants in the economic development arena, it'd be important that we winnow out businesses that might be choosing not to comply with some of our tax laws, because that seems fair. But I'm curious if we have a sense of what the universe of, I guess I'm wondering, do we have some clear examples of the problem that this would solve at times when folks have come in to get grants, only for one of our agencies to realize after the fact that that recipient happens to be failing to do the right thing on another front in terms of taxes? It'd be useful to hear of those if we have them.
Mm-hmm. Good idea. Representative Woodson?
So is there a cutoff for income from accumulated welfare services when you talk about for individuals receiving a grant? If some family is earning, say, a housing credit and they have several disabled children, their monthly income could exceed, $10,000 a month, depending on the number of children and all of the services that they're receiving. So are we saying that they are going to be exempted then from compliance with, like, cigarette and tobacco taxes? Do you see what I'm asking? Is there a cutoff here so that we aren't actually giving people a tax break on certain things when they may be having a fairly large income from the social welfare system?
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, I think that there are a number of specifically exempt types of aid, and whether those legally are considered to be grants would be a question I'd probably have to research a bit, perhaps talk to the legislative council about.
I would note that my meeting
only business.
I would note that my visit this morning from the Department of Human Services, the only discussion was on some additional exceptions that were needed. There wasn't any concern about this grants of less than $25,000 in a calendar year. That issue seems to be not significant for the department, and I think they would have mentioned that this morning in my office if that had been. Yeah, please.
I know that in another committee I'm in, they talked about not being able to communicate with each other on our social welfare system, mm-hmm. So that they don't really even know who's receiving what. And so I'm concerned that certain people could manipulate the system, if you will, and the state has no way to determine exactly who is getting what in a cumulative sense.
Right. I thank you. I think that's a very important issue. And, of course, that's still an issue whether this bill passes or not, isn't
it? Yeah, it is.
It's an issue whether the bill passes. And I think that part of Section 3 is intended to deal with at least a piece of that, that it limits the effective date of the bill to the time when the department is able to track, when they tell a alleged counsel that they're able to track. And that's when they essentially, they're taking on that chore when they're able to do it and not before. Anything else? All right, with that, we'll stay tuned for the next installment on this bill. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2169, open a public hearing on House Bill 2089.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2089 would allow individuals who owe debt to a state agency to apply to the Department of Revenue for a currently not collectible status. And so there are some concerns with the some references in the measure, I should just say out front, that it refers to debts owed to an agency under ORS 1197, 293231, and 293250. Those aren't actually enabling statutes for owing debt. They are actually statutes that enable the agencies who are owed the debt to refer them to a collection agency. Mm. And so the Department of Revenue is here to talk a bit more about that. There are concerns with the way that this is written. But the measure also would require private collection agencies to cease collection activities and return the account to the assigning agency if an individual is found to have this not collectible status. It prohibits agencies from collecting a debt by selling personal property that's exempt from execution under the bankruptcy laws, ORS 18300 to 18422. And so some examples of the types of assets that are exempt from execution under bankruptcy include retirement rollovers, VA benefits and loans, earned income tax credits, medical savings accounts, and health savings accounts. and so those types of income would not be collectible on, for the somewhat person owing debt to the state agencies. And obviously, if they were bankrupt, I think it could be discharged that way. But this is, creates a new category of individual who is on a not collectible status. And so if a person has been placed on not collectible status by the Internal Revenue Service, it would also allow them to apply for the same status in Oregon. It requires the Department of Revenue to review the status annually and renew it if an individual still qualifies. It also requires there's a specific written statement on the communications with the debtor from any agency that that they owe the debt to, and there's a specific verbiage on that for them to provide notice to the person of their options.
Okay, questions? Representative Betts?
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. I had been approached by, I'm guessing, the same gentleman that approached many of us regarding this issue, and had actually prepared a bill that does somewhat the same things as this bill does. I was trying to remember some of the concerns that he shared, and I believe one of them was the probably addressed by a subpart of this bill, which is down in paragraph 4, page 2, I believe. And it was to try to let people know when they received a letter, a demand letter, that, that their exempt income was not subject to collection activities by the department, which I thought was probably a pretty good idea, given the fact that I have had in my practice older people come in completely shaken by virtue of having received these letters, and their sole source of income was Social Security. So I do think something needs to be done. Exactly what and what the department's willing to do is the question. So I'm happy to support the bill if we get it in a form that the department is happy with.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Other comments, questions? There are no proponents of the bill signed up, but we do have three departments who want to be heard, and so let's bring them up and hear what they have to say. Rick Mills, Michael Grant, Deanna Back. And they've all indicated that they're neutral on the bill, so we'll see what they can add. Deanna, do you want to go first? Or do you want them to go first?
It's your pleasure. All right. Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Oregon Department of Revenue, and I'm here testifying on House Bill 2089. And as you pointed out, Christine has pointed out, there are some clarifying concerns we would like to have with the bill. The first is the tie to the debt owed estate agency under those particular statutes on page 1, line 12. Those debt isn't owed under those statutes. Those are means of collection. So we would recommend either deleting those statutes or deleting the language the debt is owed by a state agency or owed to a state agency, just to give us some clarification on what you intend, if it's just debt that's collected by our other agency accounts section or debt that's collected by private collection firms that this applies to, or if you intend it to apply to all debt that's collected by the state in whatever agency is being collected from.
Well, that would require reworking of lines 11 through 14 of page 1. Have I got that?
On line 12, you could delete either delete the language owed a state agency, mm-hmm. or debt owed a state agency, or you could, collecting a debt under 1.197293.231 or 293.250. That is the collections means for debt owed when it's been referred to our other agency accounts department or private collection firms. Alternatively, you could take the language out that says under those statutes, and it would just be debt owed to the state of Oregon.
Okay.
Just clarifying what your intent there is Right now, as the bill is drafted, we're unsure how many taxpayers or how many debtors for our agency this would apply to. We also don't know how many debtors it would apply to other agencies that we collect for, our other agency accounts department. We do think that there would be a fiscal for us with this one because it does seem fairly broad. Just a heads up that that might be coming. And this is all in my testimony that's online as well. Mm-hmm. I don't want to repeat it. And then there's also a concern that we don't have any appeal, right, for these people if we deny them this status. So we would like, generally, anything that we do in the Department of Revenue goes through the tax court, but generally anything related to tax collections goes through the Office of Administrative Hearings under Chapter 18, the appeals under Chapter 18, so we'd like you to tell us what to do with that. Additionally, the requirement that Representative Benz talked about to require the notice to all these debtors. Right now, we issue, as you can imagine, several hundred letters. And we don't know necessarily if the letter is to a debtor or not. We could issue, for example, a notice of deficiency to someone on an unrelated audit where they also happen to be a debtor for another tax year or another agency for that matter. So we would want some clarification there as to say, I think that when I talked to the person that Representative Benz alluded to, they were wanting our collection notices to be updated so that that information was available to them. So that we don't have any, we can do that. I just wanted some clarity there. Mm-hmm.
You might even do that without a statute change, mightn't you?
We could do that, yes.
There's nothing preventing you from doing that now, is there?
Mr. Chair, there's nothing preventing us from doing that other than probably the size of the notice. Although with our new core system, I know that there's a lot more flexibility in the content that we can put, and they're much more readable if you've seen examples. I don't know if they've shown you examples of the notices. They're not nearly as unnerving as they once were, for lack of a better word.
Representative Davis?
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. I'll let you finish, but then I've got some general questions about non-collectible status for the department.
Sure. If we do put any amount of our accounts receivable into a currently not collectible status, then we would like to, and the bill currently does not do this, but we would like to be able to report them in our LFO report as uncollectible and reduce our AR balance by those. So we'd need some conforming language, which I also provided in my written testimony. And we would also like to know if we do suspend collections, if the debt would continue to accrue interest while it's in hold status. Just clarifying points. And then under current law, and we believe as the current this bill is currently drafted, it would not preclude us from offsetting tax refunds to these groups of people. If they happen to have a tax refund that's coming to them, we would still be able to offset that to their debt. So we'd want clarification that, or at least so that you know, that's how we're currently interpreting this draft.
Of course, that's an amount that is collectible, isn't it?
Correct.
Because you already have the money in hand.
Right.
Yeah.
Another point we wanted to ensure that if the debtor does qualify for this status and they have liens in place, that we would like to leave those liens in place in the event that they have a sale of an asset, they have a lump sum item or some kind of concern there. We want to preserve our place in line because those are priority type of issues. So we'd like clarification on that. And we'd also like to get clarification if the taxpayers would like to make voluntary payments, because we do have taxpayers who have income that's exempt from garnishment, which was the situation that brought this bill, where we don't necessarily know that the income is exempt from garnishment until we get results back from the bank that says that it's or the debtor actually says, wait, this was my Social Security, and then we send it back to them because it's protected under federal and state law. But we would like to know if those people do have that exempt from garnishment income, they still voluntarily want to pay. They can pay under current law. They do pay. And they also may have other assets, household assets, that afford them the ability to pay, that with their current means of income is only exempt income from garnishment. But they have other assets that they have means to pay us. And so we'd like to allow them to continue to do that if they voluntarily want to. Let's see. There was one concern we have. The application process is to be adopted by rule for us, And generally, I'm not real clear on whether our judicial department, which is part of the judicial branch, would be bound by the executive department rules for this. I imagine that they probably would want to follow them to some degree, but I don't know if there's any issues with that. So I wanted to point that out because we're dealing with judicial branch debt. We also would like some clarity in this bill on whether we can remove, what circumstances would allow us to remove a debtor from currently not collectible status if they no longer qualify. We also would like some clarity on what to do with joint debt when one debtor is receiving protected income and the other is not. Because right now the income tax debt is joint and several. They own it. One person owes 100%, the other person owes 100%, so we can actively collect on both. And then what happens if the debtor establishes new debt, so they start adding to their bill for other tax years? Do they fall out of the status or not? Right now, the IRS has some criteria that I did put into my testimony on what they qualify for currently not collectible status. And unfortunately, they do not share that status with the Department of Revenue. It's not part of any information that they share with us. So we would not know unless the debtor told us that they were in that IRS status. And that is about, I think, everything I have. And again, this is online as well in OLIS.
Thank you. Yes, and I've been following it. It's a couple of four very dense pages of issues. Why don't we hear from the other two, and then we'll get to Representative Davis's and others' questions. Gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Michael Grant, and I'm an attorney with the Oregon Department of Justice. DOJ did submit some written testimony, and I'm not going to repeat everything that's there. I just wanted to highlight a couple of observations about the bill when I'm giving some technical feedback today. The first is that the bill may allow criminal defendants to postpone collection on their criminal money judgment obligations, including restitution. They'd be able to apply to the Department of Revenue and stop collection on those obligations for a period of time. The bill contemplates 1 year that could be renewed perpetually, possibly. And this raises the issue of how that squares with the victim's right to receive prompt restitution under the Oregon Constitution. So that's one observation. The second one, Deanna Mack alluded to that, is that the bill as it's written right now would not allow the Department of Revenue to revisit and reverse a not collectible determination. Under the bill as it's written now, if the revenue decides that a debtor qualifies to be on the not collectible list, they're on the list. And nothing would allow them to change that for at least the period of time, the 1 year or even longer. And that's an issue if revenue discovers that a debtor acquires new assets or discovers that it wasn't given the full financial picture about a debtor, each of which can happen. The third observation I'd like to make is that the bill could be interpreted to prevent collection against partially exempt assets. Under Oregon law, Chapter 18, many assets have exemptions of various amounts. Not the entire thing is exempt, but part of it is exempt. Example might be somebody who has a nice sports car, and a sports car, just like any other automobile, carries a $3,000 personal property exemption. This bill could be interpreted to prevent revenue or even maybe another state agency, because it does say other state agencies, from requesting or requiring that a nice asset be liquidated simply because a portion of it is exempt from execution. Two other observations. One is the obvious one, I suppose, that it would require a lot of revamping of forms for a lot of different agencies. The bill as it's written says all written communications. I'll tell you, in my office, we communicate with debtors a lot. Sometimes it's a demand letter. Sometimes it's a back and forth with a pro se debtor via email when they're saying, I'm going to miss my payment this month. Can I come back next month and make twice the payment? As written, this bill would require us, each time one of those emails went out, to put in the additional notice. And then the final observation is this. The bill, as it's presently written, could be interpreted to prevent state agencies from collecting debts that haven't even been assigned to the Department of Revenue. If the Department of Revenue makes a not currently collectible determination, it then potentially would bind other agencies. Here's where that becomes a possible issue. Sometimes debtors owe more than one debt, and some of those debts have a statute of limitations. All of you probably know that the state, as a general matter, doesn't have a statute of limitations for filing suit. But there are exceptions to that, and those come up, for example, if the state agency has taken an assignment of another person's cause of action, think in the workers' compensation context, for example. Another place it comes up is in bankruptcy court. If I have to file a non-dischargeability action to preserve a state debt from being discharged, I have a very limited amount of time to do that. Other situations might include filing claims against estates or filing proofs of claim in the bankruptcy court. If those actions are stayed because they'd be deemed to be an attempt to collect a debt, that could result in the state losing the ability to collect that second debt. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name's Rick Mills. I'm a policy analyst with the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery, Department of Human Services. I share many of the questions that my colleagues have, and I'll try not to repeat any of those, but I think the biggest one for us at the Department of Human Services is, as you know, we have a number of programs that receive federal funds, and we have to comply with federal mandates. And some of those mandates deal with our efforts and responsibilities to collect money that is due under federal regulations and federal law. Most notably, of course, we're talking about Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP, and we're also talking about the Medicaid program. Just as an example, under the SNAP program, we are one of the few people that can actually, in essence, collect against what is otherwise a protected public benefit. If you have received an overpayment on your SNAP benefit, that is to say you got more SNAP benefits than you were legally entitled to receive, we are required by federal regulation to reduce future SNAP benefits by a small amount until that overpayment is paid off. So, for instance, dealing with that disclosure statement, which starts on line 10 on the second page of the bill, we would be concerned about making statements saying to people that certain things are off limit when, in fact, we would be able to collect against that when nobody else would. Similarly, there is a federal requirement for the SNAP program that we participate in the Treasury Offset Program. And that means that about November, December of each year, we send a list off to the federal government of each person who has a SNAP overpayment. And the federal government will intercept that individual's income tax return for that SNAP overpayment. If this bill were to prohibit us from engaging in those debt collection activities, that would possibly jeopardize our federal funds for the SNAP program. I have some other concerns in the context of these restrictions on debt collection in context of our Medicaid program, particularly our personal injury lien program and our estate recovery program. So those are really our biggest concerns, is that we might find ourselves somehow being crosswise with federal mandates. Other things that we might be concerned about and need some questions and clarifications on is, I know, for instance, we have at least one program in DHS where the individual has to make a monthly payment to participate in the program. If that individual were to fail to make that monthly payment, then we would normally terminate that person's benefits, and arguably that may constitute an effort to an attempt to collect a debt. And we could find ourselves prohibited from being able to terminate that individual's benefits for non-payment of the monthly fee that that individual has to pay. So those are just some of the, we also have a bill that we're hoping to see in the legislature here, which will allow us to intercept lottery winnings. And if we're not allowed to attempt to collect a debt, then that would probably interfere with our ability to intercept lottery winnings for some of these individuals. I think the bill also, another question that we're concerned about is changes in financial status of the individual. If the individual receives a large inheritance 2 months after they get on the list, or they win $5 million in the lottery, it raises, I think, some very interesting questions. So lastly, we think this will create a significant workload issue for our agency, because we will never know from one day to the next, 1 hour to the next, when an individual will be on this non-collectible status list. And that means that every time, the first step in any sort of communication with an individual, we would have to first look to see, are they on the non-collectible status list? And if they are, then we would be prohibited from moving forward. But if we do, that takes 5-10 minutes each time, multiple times a day, multiple individuals, that eventually adds up to a significant workload issue. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Before we get to Representative Davis's questions, I think I don't normally do this, but I would say that the most I would likely want to consider on a bill like this would be a provision that required the Department of Revenue to include a statement about the exempt sources when they send a bona fide collections letter. And I'm not certain I would favor that bill even, but this bill is much broader than that. Knowing that that's the chair's inclination, Representative Davis, go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to also limit the discussion to the department, because I think that was a specific issue brought to many of us in the interim. And for that purpose, I'd like to get the department's background. We got deep in the minutiae of this bill, but for purposes of a debtor who does have simply protected income and makes the department aware of that now, if they're in a collectible status, what is the department's current response?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, the right now, when we're collecting on a debt, we work with the taxpayer under the Taxpayer Bill of Rights to enter into a payment plan so that they can do this voluntarily. If we have to move to enforced collections, usually we end up with in garnishment. We issue a garnishment, and there are several responses that can happen to the garnishment. The garnishment response can come back, say there's no money. The garnishment response, because of 2009 Senate Bill 731, can come back saying the only income in the account is protected income, and so the bank won't send it to us. So that's been a very effective piece of legislation. And if in the event that the bank doesn't know that it's Social Security or retirement or some source of protected income, then they will send us they'll send us the money. The taxpayer has a right to notify us that it's exempt money. They send a bank statement, we look at it, or you know, somehow show us their Social Security statement, whatever it is, and we return the money to them promptly. So there's a method in place now to deal with that. But if they tell us, if they work with us in the first place and they tell us that their only source of income is exempt income, then we have means to put them in hold status and I mean, just on our own. We know that they're not collectible. We might even consider them for a settlement offer or cancellation of debt.
Follow up real quick. You follow up.
Please.
You mentioned hold status, mm-hmm. which sounds remarkably similar to not currently collectible. So what is hold status?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, we just put the collector that's working with the taxpayer will say, we'll check back with you again in 6 months. We'll check back with you again in, you know, however long it is that they need to, that they've agreed to check back with them. So they won't do any action on the account. They'll pend it, and they'll just follow up, you know, at the agreed upon time. To check back to see if there are other assets. More likely than not, they're going to consider them for cancellation because it's currently uncollectible under 305-155.
And one more follow-up, more of a comment. I think the issue in the chair, you were getting to this, is perhaps taxpayers don't know their rights. And I think that was the primary issue that the individual brought to us, is people who are sending their
Social Security. Everybody, didn't he?
Yes. Who are sending their Social Security money in because they're not aware currently that it's protected. And
yes.
It doesn't sound like the department has any affirmative obligation, or I don't know if information is shared with the taxpayer, or is it that certain income and assets are protected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, there's nothing that requires us to tell them that, although we do tell them if they engage with us, we do tell them that kind of stuff is exempt from garnishment. It's protected income. We can't forcibly collect it from them, but if they choose to pay us, they can.
Thank you.
Representative Leininger?
I'm just curious. I mean, it sounds like this, you're speaking of very complex processes, which is probably a reason why everyone here is taking a lot of pause about the bill as drafted. But what's the size of the money universe we're even talking about? I mean, this is such a, it's a very narrow segment of the population, right? And I mean, is this like $100,000 worth of issue in the aggregate annually? Is it less? More?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, I would have to look to see what the LFO report says our AR balances are, but my understanding is the Judicial Department has a very, very, very high balance, and I understand they, although I don't think they're here, I do believe, and maybe Michael can correct me, that they have, I think a large percentage of those people would probably qualify under this bill. For revenue, we haven't been able to quantify that yet, because I do know that we have quite a few. I think we looked and we have about, let me look at my testimony. I want to say there was 500 and just in our personal income tax program, we had 572,000 taxpayers that had listed protected income on their tax return. So of 1.9 million taxpayers, that's a pretty big chunk. So I don't know how much that equates to the debt balance that we carry, right. But I want to say our debt balance is pretty high.
Yeah. Yes,
Paul. Please. Yeah.
Because it sort of makes me think about, you know, so of the people who wouldn't pay you no matter what, whether you called them every single day or never again, I mean, there's probably a fair chunk of the people in the outstanding receivables who fall into that category. So of the people who would otherwise pay but who wouldn't pay because of these protections, I guess you're appropriately noting that you're not sure what that amount is. But I guess I would just surmise that it's not probably a very big universe of people. And
well, let me follow up on that. I'm assuming that the department doesn't want to waste time trying to collect money from somebody who doesn't have it or from whom you can't collect it because their assets are all protected.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And that, therefore, you will do the things that you can to screen out that activity so you can spend the time on activity that will actually produce a financial result for the state.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. And we have protections in 305, 155 that deal with exactly that issue.
I mean, but administratively, mm-hmm. that's of interest to the department, whether there's a rule about it or not, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Yes, Representative Whitson.
So does the Judicial Department that you're referring to refer to fines that are collected during traffic, that sort of thing? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, my understanding from our other agency accounts unit, where we collect a bulk of the OJD's debt, it's that it is court fines and restitution payments, that kind of stuff, that school loans, a variety of different debts that we collect on their behalf.
Okay, if I may follow up.
Yeah, please.
So it's been my understanding in the past they have not had an ongoing program to collect the debt. Is that correct? That's like the same as the Department of Revenues.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I do believe that is correct, that they attempt to collect it, I think, very minimal or first touch type of thing, and then they send it to our other agency accounts unit to collect.
So I believe there is a very large amount of money that is owed to the Judicial Department. If it's my understanding, somewhere in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I think, yeah, it's all online. I don't know exactly what the total AR balances are, but I do know that Department of Revenue carries a bulk of that, and OJD carries the other, and I think Child Support maybe, Department of Justice, I think.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, the amounts of outstanding either tax debt or debt connected with other things like child support is enormous.
Right. Close to a billion is what
Well, I suspect it's actually more than that.
Yeah.
When you add it all together. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much for coming today. I appreciate it very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2089? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2089.
Yeah.
We'll open a work session on Introduction of committee bills. Representative Vance.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3619, dated 2/17/15, be admitted as a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Vance moves LC 3619 be submitted as a committee bill. With the usual caveats, is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion carries, and the bill will be submitted as a committee bill. I will note, colleagues, that tomorrow is, it is tomorrow, is the last day for that you will have to consider a motion like this, because that's the timeout time for the submission of committee bills. With that, we'll close the work session, and we'll open an information meeting on the OLCC overview. And as usual, you get the honors.
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the honors. With the OLCC, I guess it's time to have a party. The OLCC collects, as you know, when we've talked about it, the taxes on both beer and wine, as well as distilled spirits, and also their role is expanding, and you expressed, the committee expressed the desire to learn more about their processes and some of their issues that they regulate. So we asked the OLCC, Director Steve Marks and Bill Schuette, their economists, to come and give you an overview of that process. And now they have that presentation for you that will clarify everything.
Great. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. With me is Bill Schuette, our economist. I just have a few comments before Bill gets on with his overview. First, you know, in this, we're moving from $1.1 to $1.2 billion in overall revenue. We're the third largest revenue source for the state and expect in 15-17 to distribute $470 million to our general fund, cities, counties, and other purposes in the distribution that Bill will go through with you. A few caveats on the numbers you will see. First, we have a new program, the recreational marijuana program. A lot has been made over the revenues that are potential from that program. I would say this, there is an estimate that was put in the governor's budget on revenues that's dependent a lot on our timing of implementation, as Representative Leiniger knows, and the Joint Committee is working on some of the legislation that may guide our process. What I would say is this. We're going to be borrowing from the liquor fund about $1.2 million in the remainder of this biennium for a total, by the time we get through 15-17, of about $7.2 to $7.5 million when we put that budget together. It's our intention and plan to pay back the liquor fund before distributing revenues through the marijuana program. Another caveat here is Representative Whitsitt knows she served on the subcommittee of Ways and Means, Transportation and Economic Development, where we presented our budget. There are threats to the liquor revenue forecast presented by our limitations of our warehouse. We are near throughput. We have $10 million of capital investments that we are proposing to make in the warehouse. The primary issue there is to gain the capacity to load our outshipments by more than one bay at a time. Amazingly, over the year and 4 months I've been there, I've learned every bottle of liquor goes out on a truck through one bay loading at a time. Wow. Proposing to buy a system of conveyors and sortation, it's called, but the software that runs that would allow us to load multiple trucks. And with that, we'll avoid the threats to the forecast. So with that, I'll let Bill Schuette get on with our presentation.
For the record, Chair of Committee, Bill Schuette, for the economist for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. We always like to start these with a little bit of overview of the commission, because some people aren't familiar with it other than our selling of spirits and regulating of beer and wine. History of the commission, it was formed in 1933 after Prohibition. Legislature at that time determined a control system was appropriate for that for the state of Oregon. The control system used a moderate approach by eliminating tactics such as incentives for maximum sales from the marketplace. So what that really means, the state has the exclusive right to sell distilled spirits. Profits from these sales, which I'll be talking about, are captured at the wholesale and retail levels and return to benefit state and local governments. And then most recently, the additional recreational marijuana regulation has been given to us with the passage of Measure 91. So what do we do in the commission? We license businesses that sell alcohol. We issue service permits to train alcohol servers, primarily bars and restaurants. We manage and distribute distilled spirits, and that by definition is the control part of our system. We regulate businesses that sell and serve alcohol. We do provide public information about the responsible use of alcohol. Of course, we generate revenue for essential services like police, education, and health care. We do have an administrative hearings unit, so if licensees get in trouble or receive administrative violations, they are allowed due process, and that's what our hearings unit does. And then what many people don't know is we are in charge of regulation of Oregon's bottle bill, including siting and redemption centers. And, of course, most recently, the implementation of Measure 91. Primarily, most of the revenue is generated from our Oregon liquor stores, 248 working liquor stores through the state, 144 what we call exclusive, which is primarily sales of liquor with some related items, and then 104 non-exclusive, which is sale of liquor and usually something else. I think there's about 35 or so or more of those that actually are combined with convenience stores and grocery stores through the state. So looking at the projected gross revenue sources for the 15-17 biennium, most of them come from liquor. It's an OLIS, but it's not showing up here. So the $1.15 billion comes from liquor sales, a smaller portion from beer and wine, $36.6 million. License fees from alcohol licenses, $11.7 million, and projected, and we'll talk about where the marijuana tax is coming from at $16.5 million at the end of this presentation. That's currently in the GRB. 10-year forecast for gross liquor sales, that's the bulk of our revenue, where it comes from. Upcoming biennium, $1.13 billion. Over the last 20 years, liquor sales has averaged 5.6% average annual growth compared to a CPI or inflation of about 2.6, so well over inflation. Bulk of that, again, goes to distribution.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the last point. The bulk goes to distribution.
I'll get to the rest of it, but the rest of it goes to distribution in the general fund and to cities and counties.
Thank you. Now I understand.
Most of the revenue distributed to cities and counties comes to from the liquor.
Thank you.
This is a current distilled spirits operating model. So based on average $16.50 bottle price, about half of that is the manufacturer's cost, so that's the cost of goods delivered into the warehouse. 8.88% goes to the liquor store operators, the retail liquor stores is their commission. About 1% of that, which the state pays for, is credit card cost, and then 4% of that is the entire OLCC operating expense, which includes all of enforcement, licensing, administration, and distribution functions, with the remaining 37% being distributed for to the state, cities, and counties.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
A quick question on this page, thank you. So the average bottle price, I'm assuming you mean average, like add them all together and divide as opposed to
Yes,
median.
Chair, Representative Warner, it's the total revenue divided by the total number of bottles.
Great. And then also, if I may follow up briefly, I'm impressed that your bank card costs are only 1%.
Cost I think is about 1.7%. Mm-hmm. So 1.1% of every bottle is bank card cost,
which you obviously don't pay when they pay in cash.
Right.
Right.
So about 70% of all transactions are currently bank cards or credit cards, and the remaining 30% are cash.
Looking at this chart, I begin to understand why it is that the state of Washington had to ended up with significantly higher liquor prices because the the distribution costs that private businesses face are enormous compared to what you pay.
Yes, Chair Barnhart, that's correct. Imagine that small orange centers in the middle of it being replaced by the wholesale and retail markup, and that was what happened in Washington.
Right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Talk a little bit about the markup formula. The commission itself does not set the price of liquor, but we do establish what the markup formula is. This is for your reference. If you want to go back and look at it, I'll go through an example, which is an easier way to do it. But basically, the average markup is about 104% of the average manufacturer's cost in 2014. And the formula's purpose is really to assign a higher markup to lower value products than higher value products as a mechanism to hopefully moderate consumption of lower value products. And I'll go through an example. It gets a bit convoluted, but we have to start on a case basis. So, for example, a $10 bottle of vodka, $7.50, which is about 12 bottles per case, or a total of 120 per case. We add 1445, multiply it by a factor, add freight, divide it by the number of bottles per case, round it up to the nearest 5 cents, and then add the 50-cent surcharge, which I'll talk about shortly. So in this case, I think it marked it up an average of about 108%. So that's really how we come up with the price of liquor. So the price is really determined by the manufacturers. They run it through this formula. And if they want a discount, then they reduce the cost per case.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Davis.
Thank you. Is the formula statutory or by rule?
It's by rule, by the commission. So the formula in action, just for 750 milliliter bottles or fifths, on the left is the landed cost per bottle or the cost from the manufacturer. And you can see as it goes up on the right-hand side, the higher it goes, the lower the markup rate. So actually, the first two lines are probably not realistic. We're not selling any fifths for $4.90 a bottle, maybe a vodka. But I think $7 is safe to start and then going up from there. So again, lower value items have a higher markup rate, and higher value items have a lower markup rate. But again, the average rate for the state is about 104%. A bit about the 50-cent surcharge. The current 50-cent per bottle surcharge has been extended by the commission through June 30th, 2017. It is in the governor's recommended budget. It is expected to generate $33.8 million for the 15-17 biennium. This distribution of this revenue is determined by the legislature, although historically it's gone to the general fund.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. What's the genesis of the surcharge and its stated purpose and role?
Co-Chair Representative Davis, surcharge itself was a mechanism developed back in 2009 when the state started facing some revenue issues and liquor sales did start to taper off. It is a mechanism that is totally under the control of the commission. The commission votes on it and establishes a surcharge, and then they have to extend the surcharge every biennium. So since 2009, they've elected to extend that surcharge every biennium. But it's totally under the purview of the commission.
Thank you.
So beyond liquor, we also do collection of beer and wine tax. The beer tax is rounding it, it's tax per barrel, but rounding it out, it's about 8 cents per gallon. I think it was last established in 1977. The wine tax is at 67 cents per gallon, pretty much established in 77. There was a modification in the mid-90s that added 2 cents a gallon to fund the Oregon Wine Board, but the primary 65 cent per gallon charge of that has remained unchanged since 77. What's interesting to me as an economist on the graph is the relative change of wine tax collections versus beer tax collections. Back in 2003, wine tax exceeded beer tax and somewhat leveling off of the beer tax. In the 15-17 biennium, we will expect a total for beer and wine of $36.6 million. Over the last 20 years, this revenue source has increased an average of about 2.5% average annual growth, which is about equal with inflation.
And this is only this is on a tax on beer and wine sold in Oregon.
Yes, Chair Barnhart, it is a tax only sold on beer and wine in Oregon and is collected at the wholesale level.
So if a winery ships a bottle of wine out of state, the tax is not collected.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct.
Thank you.
But if a winery sells tax sells wine within the state of Oregon, tax is collected.
Right.
A little bit part of our revenue stream as well is annual liquor license fee revenue. Just for reference, an off-premises license fee, which are generally grocery stores or convenience stores, are $100 per year. An on-premises license fee, generally bars and restaurants, are $400 per year. We are expecting 15-17, a collection of approximately $11.7 million. This revenue source has grown an average of 4.7% over the last 20 years, much higher than inflation. But the license fees themselves are in statute and have not changed. I can't remember how far back they go, but it's been a long time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Is there a limit in the number of fees that are fees that you will allow people to, you know, is there a limit, like only so many grocery stores can have one of these, only so many bars and restaurants that's administered through the OLCC, or is there no limit at all, or is it a local issue?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Warner. In statute, the commission itself is allowed to moderate or limit if it so chooses, but in practice, there's been no limit on number of licenses issued.
And it's a huge controversy in some places.
I was going to say, if I may, where
Please.
I grew up, it is much more tightly controlled, and it's a big deal when a place closes down that has a liquor license, because that means there's another liquor license available to buy, and it becomes, but that is not the case in Oregon at all.
Chair Representative Warner, that is not the case in Oregon. Liquor licenses are not a real property value like they are in some other states. They are just simply a privilege to operate, and generally when someone applies for a license, there's probably a 99% plus chance they'll get a license. That's our approval rate.
Thank you.
Right. Now, this liquor license includes beer and wine, does it not?
The off-premise license fee for grocery store and convenience stores are for the sales of beer and wine. The on-premise license fee in bars and restaurants is for the serving of beer, wine, and spirits.
Okay, thank you.
There are other license fees in between those two amounts for wineries and brew pubs and breweries, and I think we have a host of about 12 or so different license types that are generally in the same range of fees.
Yes, Representative Baker Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. So just about the 99.9% of the liquor license fees, so we actually have had, I'm also on my neighborhood association board, and we've had a lot of folks who have come looking to establish a bar or something in a neighborhood where one is closed down or have a new one, and there's been a lot of concern with the impacts on the neighborhood of these places going up, and especially if they're replacing some place where there's been known problems before. And I think it's a little disturbing that there's 99.9% acceptance rate. And I just wanted to find out if you feel the same way, or if what you're doing in terms of like taking a closer look at some of the applications that are going through.
Take this one.
Rep. Barnhart, Chair Barnhart, Rep. Megan Peterson. So this has been an issue at the commission that I've learned about over the last year and 4 months. We have issues with our approvals. Our approvals generally are at the commission, we have very little basis on which to disapprove liquor licenses in the state of Oregon, irrespective of local recommendations. I've found it interesting that we get recommendations frequently from local governments, say, and we have a consultative process, right, within our licensing. They ask us to deny, and we say, based on the law and the qualifications and your standards, you are approved by the commission. Now, the commission, by rule, could try to limit saturation in some areas, but we found it difficult to do. And from case law and history, the commission has never developed such a rule. But we do think it would be difficult under our existing statute to deny those licenses. And it is a problem in several places throughout Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Representative Vega Peterson, anything else?
No, but I think I would be interested in talking about this with you forever.
I detected that possibility. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Well, apparently I represent the one client who's been declined by the OLCC. and I just, for the edification of the committee, I thought the interesting piece is it had nothing to do with my client, but he purchased a location that it turned out had later turned out it had a 50 or 100 complaints from Portland police.
Ooh.
And so it was actually the local jurisdiction, but City of Portland, I don't think, issued a recommendation against it, but Portland police did to the OLCC, and at that point, OLCC decided that because of the location in and around near downtown and some of the other neighborhood issues, that they were not going to allow, at least initially, the establishment of an on-premise license, that they would allow some very, very circumscribed circumstances, only serving a couple hours a day, no spirits, but so basically slowly moving into compliance over a period of a few years.
So you change the culture in the immediate neighborhood
exactly
over time, and then perhaps a more complete license that
yes.
your client wanted. Representative Vega Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I did have one. It wasn't really a question, but more of a comment. I mean, the experience that we had is we were, even if we wanted to recommend, let's say, some guidelines to say we want to have a conditional approval, we were been told that. You have to say that you don't want it there at all. That's the only chance of even getting some conditional approval. So I would love to work with you more on figuring out what this process, how it currently stands and how we can make it better in order to, you know, respect the business owners who want to go there, but also the neighborhoods and communities that that they're opening their business in.
And if you think this is a controversial topic, just wait for the marijuana thing to happen.
Representative Barnhart, if I may, and Vega Peterson, I would just say I come from a community solutions background, so I find this process a bit difficult, especially when we call for recommendations and then we hardly respect those. I would just draw to your attention what you don't see are those cases where sometimes we have questions about whether we're going to provide a license or not, and the local recommendation has actually been favorable. Those have impacted me more than not from local recommendations. We don't see those because they take place within our process, but I have actually been able to work with the commission and others where we've actually respected the wishes of the community the other direction. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vega Peterson, I would do a caveat on that 99% approval, and those are just licensees that have elected to go through the entire process. Mm-hmm. Right now, between 6% and 10% of our licensees don't complete the process, and may be part of a result of a community recommendation or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a completely different result,
yes.
Then, isn't it? It means that you approve about 93% of the initial applicants get all the way through.
Yes.
Yeah.
The biennial liquor revenue distributions to the general fund cities and counties, that comes out of that revenue pot that I showed you previously, expected to be $470 million in the governor's recommended budget in 15-17. This has shown an average annual growth of 5.5% growth over the last 20 years, well above inflation. This current biennium, we're expecting, and our forecast is pretty close, $442 million of distribution by the end of this biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Just a quick question on that chart. It's interesting how relatively flat the numbers were from 77 till 97 approximately, and then how mm-hmm. any historical input you can give us on why that is?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner. I think most of it has been due to the population growth of the state of Oregon. You'll see back in the 81-83 era a bit of a rise, then a decline. In our forecast modeling, we actually do a sub-cohort or subgroup of the population to try to project it. This group is 21 to 30-year-olds. In 81, 83, that is when the baby boomers peaked in their 20s. And since then, it's been a combination of that and just general population growth.
Yes, Representative Woodson and then Representative Johnson.
I was just wondering if you keep track of alcoholism. Does the agency keep track of that at all? I was wondering if you see a correlation between the growth of revenue from liquor and alcoholism in the population in general.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, we do not track alcoholism per se. We do track things like DUI. We do monitor the reports from the Healthy Teen Survey on alcohol and teen drinking and that sort of thing. We do have some measures for public safety around second violations. Number of businesses that commit a second violation in the second year or within 2 years of committing the first violation. We also have a measure in our key performance measure of our compliance checks. When we check businesses with minor decoys, last year it was 82%, and that has been a trend of increase in compliance over the last 10 years. But per se, we don't check alcoholism, but we do monitor consumption. We do monitor consumption. So consumption has been somewhat level. There's been some changing of alcohol consumption, switching from beer to wine and spirits over the last 10 years. But generally, it's been pretty level on a per capita basis.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How is the revenue distributed to cities and counties incrementally?
Co-chair,
you're getting there.
We'll get to the next slide here.
One other follow-up, maybe you already covered it, but what formula do you use for distribution?
That formula is in statute.
Which is?
Statutory formula about, well, let's see what it looks like here. it's about 54% of the general fund, and then
what's this next slide?
Incorporated cities and all those numbers are in statute.
So, Mr. Chair, it's 54% to the general fund. The wine board gets 2 cents from the top of the wine tax, and they put them all together. 54% goes to the general fund, 34% goes to cities, and 10% goes to counties.
Okay, and that is your next chart.
Yes, and here is the distribution for the current biennium where the expected revenue is going to go. And again, you notice a smaller amount, the $6.38 for the Oregon Wine Board. That's based on the 2 cents per gallon.
And so the more sales there are, the more money actually goes to mental health, alcoholism, and drug services as
yes.
well.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's half of the beer and wine combined. Half of it goes to the mental health, alcoholism, drug services before everything else goes to the general distribution.
I see. Okay. And I see two hands over here. Representative Weininger first.
Thanks. So it's really interesting to look at this pie chart because in Clackamas County, half of the population lives in unincorporated areas outside of cities. A lot of them are very city-like. You have your facility. It might even be in an unincorporated area, the OLCC facility, or maybe it's Milwaukee. But so a huge number of our people choose not to be in incorporated cities and feel sort of pride of not being in a cityness about it. But a lot of where they live is just as urban as anybody else's urban area. But as a result of their choice to not incorporate into cities, they forego a huge amount of revenue. Because if you take a look at this, a much greater share of the money goes to cities than counties. And so they're leaving a bunch of money on the table. I'm sure that's not news to you, and it's not news to a lot of people in counties, but it's really shocking when you think about I don't think a lot of people are thinking about that decision. You probably have a lot of unincorporated residents in your communities, too.
Mostly.
Yeah. Representative Woodson?
Yes, I was wondering if your distribution is per capita, then when you look at the counties and the cities, is that a determination made per capita on the distribution formula?
You know,
of the tax?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, yes. Okay. We use the official projections by, I think, Portland State University, the Population Center, for both city and county distributions.
Representative Whitsitt, just to add to that, the cities and counties, they started at a long time ago at 10% each based on population. Then there was a city formula that was prior to the state controlling the amounts. And that's where the 14% came, and it was by a different formula altogether. So that's why the cities end up with a lot more than the counties, because there was that before everything was said and done. There was an additional 14% dedicated for the cities in statutes.
Yeah. So for example,
please,
if you may,
yeah.
We have a city of 18,000. Within the incorporated part of the city in Klamath, and about 68,000 in the county. And there are a couple small cities that, you know, might have 100 people or whatever in it. So a county like that, large county with people outside, and I'm sure Rep. Benz has the same thing in his district, the counties are really not getting their fair share. Compared to other places, perhaps. I mean, alcoholism is a big problem in our counties because we don't have any centers for drying out. So they end up in the jail. The jails don't have any money in some of these counties, to keep them open. And so it's just like a cyclical deal, and we just don't have enough money to deal with the people that are outside of cities, and the counties are kind of sparsely populated. But it's per capita, we have a fairly substantial problem with mental illness, a lot of it related to alcoholism. And I know that's not really why you're here, but it is an issue when you look at the distribution pattern of where the money goes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what we might do is finish the presentation.
Sorry.
And then if we have a couple more minutes, perhaps the director could talk a little bit about enforcement issues, unless we have him back for something else later.
So we're on, okay, so Chair Barnhart, we're on the last slide here.
Yeah.
So this is our, I thought I should bring marijuana into the picture since it is a big task of the agency now. This is the governor's recommended budget for 91. I put in big letters that this will change. It's anticipated to change both on the expenditure and revenue. And the original expenditures were developed during the analysis for the voters pamphlet and the financial estimates committee and some previous bills where this was introduced, along with the revenue projections. As we gather more information from states like Colorado and Washington and even within Oregon about how and what implementation will look like, we'll refine our expenditure estimates, and I believe to our legislative revenue office will also hopefully refine their revenue estimates. Projected distribution. Based on the governor's recommended budget and those projected costs are expected to be about $9.1 million, but that is a very, very tenuous number for this coming biennium. So that's all I'll say about that.
All righty. Thank you very much. The point of setting up an OLCC in the first place, in 1933, if I understand it, was first to deal with enforcement issues. We were trying to put criminal gangs out of business then, and dealing with access to by minors and habitual drunkards and people like that. That was 1933. That's still a major concern for the commission, isn't it?
Yes.
And it will be when you come to dealing with recreational marijuana use, I'm assuming.
Chair Barnhart, in our alcohol program, the two highest concerns are access by minors to alcohol and visibly intoxicated persons and sales to them. Mm-hmm. So when we look at enforcement, we look to that first. I would say, you know, over the period of time, we recognize that we have developed an extensive minor decoy program in this state. We implement that statewide. I would say the regime of checks is only about 15%, I'm looking at Bill Schutte, of our licensees per year. So that is a standard that I think has implications when you think about what we want and perhaps the marijuana program for recreational marijuana, just to give you a benchmark there. We have a substantial caseload that goes, of course, we have a substantial quasi-judicial in prosecuting and following up on our administrative and our sanctions, criminal sanctions within the agency. We have an entire quasi-judicial process that we run for the sanctions system. As you know, that's an extensive part of our work as well. And I can give you, if you don't mind, without having the actual numbers, I'll give you a sense of our statewide distribution. We have 5 regional offices. Most of the enforcement is located in the Portland region. These are the numbers. I'll provide them to the committee and get accurate ones. But I think it was about 18 to 16 in Portland, and then we are about 8 to 7 people within the region. They carry out licensing responsibilities, inspection responsibilities, and as you know, our agency sort of operates in every community or throughout the state every evening. We're an agency that's opened about 20 hours a day, 6 days a week usually, once in a while longer. So it gives you a sense of what we do. We have how many satellite offices today? We are at 5, 7, I believe.
5 regions, 7, yeah.
It's now. So just to give you a sense of our field enforcement force.
Other questions, comments?
Oh.
I'm sorry. Did I interrupt you? I would like to simply add a comment. I've lived in Oregon since my parents brought me and my brothers here in 1949 when I was a very young child, and I've watched the evolution of the agency and its level of strictness and requirements and how tight things were. And I want to commend you for the agency for the changes that have come about in the last decade or so as you have maintained your level of public safety concern, and yet at the same time allowed the development in Oregon of our local distilleries, the development of our wineries and their tasting rooms, the development of a variety of other things that don't compromise public safety but do help us develop our industrial sector involving high-quality alcoholic beverages and liquor. In my district, there are several small liquor stores, usually non-exclusive stores connected with other shops. There are at least a couple of them that would simply not be in business if it weren't for the fact that they had the liquor store along with the variety store or the small grocery store. And that way, the result of that is that there's another business in a small town that would not exist otherwise. If we went to a system that allowed a Safeway and Walmart and those other large retailers to control the sale of liquor, those businesses would all disappear, and those who wanted to buy liquor would have to travel many more miles to get to the places where those stores exist. In addition, of course, to the comment I made earlier about the prices that would change. I have to tell you that I think the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is one of Oregon's shining stars in terms of how you run your business, how you do it inexpensively and with great efficiency, and you're to be commended for that. And the cliche that we have, that a government-run business cannot be effective, is simply wrong, demonstrably wrong, not true when it comes to the operation of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And I for one, appreciate very much both the wisdom of the people who set up the system and the continued operations within that framework that you and the commission have pursued. I want to thank you for that. Any other comments? Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, yes. I just might build on a couple of your points there,
please,
if you wouldn't mind. 12% of our spirits revenue is from Oregon producers. You know, when you saw the $1.1 billion. So it's an important part of our economy. A lot of those, Hood River is the largest producer, but we have employment throughout every region of the state, and we will send to you the Joint Interim committee on OLCC actually did extensive work, looked at our budget, looked at our investments, looked at our operations. One of the things we were able to do is look at our impact on the economy, and the State Economist actually put together a real excellent report on the impacts we have on the overall economy, and we'll make sure the committee members get a copy of that.
Please include that, and please post it in this OLIS segment, if you would. That would be very helpful. Just a quick story. I was at Sun River last weekend. The country store was open on Sunday. I think maybe this was Saturday. It was open on Saturday. One of the people I was traveling with went into that shop and found that there was a display case of Oregon products in the very small liquor store, which was part of the country general grocery store operation, with its own cash registers, its own walled-off area and so forth. I don't know whether that was you or the retailer who came up with that idea, but it's a great idea. We have people traveling here from all over the country to ski or to do other things in places like that. Having a display of Oregon brands made in Oregon, producing Oregon jobs, is a fantastic idea. Maybe we'll start selling some of these things in other places and displace London and Kentucky a little bit. And with that, anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Paul? Paul's going to say something about tomorrow. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. The agenda for tomorrow has two bills on it. One is a 2555, which is a cigarette tax increase proposal. The other is House Bill 2171. That is a gut and stuff. It's related to taxation, so we have pulled that contents completely out of that and substituted in a proposed increase in the beer tax, which is appropriate following your presentation. So that amendment is in OLIS. It's a dash 2, 2171-2 amendment, so I just wanted to make sure you're aware that that's the topic for the public hearing tomorrow rather than the original bill.
Right, and that means we'll have a very large group of people in the audience, at least at the beginning of the meeting, half of whom will leave immediately when they discover that the hearing isn't about AGI, it's about beer.
We'll have a different group, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll tell them
yet. All right. Thank you, Paul. Thank you. If there's nothing else, thank you all. The committee's adjourned. See you tomorrow.